good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And we need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being because we have, we're hoping this evening to have Charlotte Isabey. If not, we'll have John Spring. And until one of them gets here, I'm just going to tell you a few of the things that are of concern to me. And one of them is the fact that the war with Iraq was planned long before the attack on September 11th. And you can find suggestions that our government intended to go to war with Iraq, well, going back to certainly right after the Kuwait War in 1991. And we know that shortly after that, the Carlyle Corporation. Now, Carlyle Corporation is a multi-billion-dollar organization run by Frank Carlucci and James Baker III, and the present time, of course, George Herbert Walker Bush and Kissinger are both associated with this, and many of the movers and shakers in Washington. But in the early 1990s, Carlyle bought the rights to the Bradley fighting vehicle. Now, why would anybody want to buy the rights to the Bradley fighting vehicle? After all, nobody expected we'd be having more wars. After all, America was the last superpower. Russia had collapsed. The idea that there'd be a great war in the Middle East was the furthest thing from the mind of the average individual, but obviously not from the minds of the people at Carlyle. And it was about the same time that, of course, they changed the uniforms of our soldiers, traditionally the green fatigues and khakis, and suddenly, well, I suppose this was before the first Gulf War, why they're in uniforms that would fade into the Iraqi desert. But we know, for instance, from an article that appears in a book called Fighting Modern Wars. It's a book written by Wesley Clark, and he talked about having gone to the Pentagon just about a month after the September 11th attack, and meeting one of his military friends there, a high officer in the Pentagon, who said that they'd been actually planning on the war in the Middle East for many years. And of course, if you go to the website, newamericancentury.org, that's newamericancentury.org, and go to the section talking about rebuilding America's defenses 2000, and this was published in the year 2000, I believe in January. It says this: the United States has for decades sought to play a more permanent role in Gulf regional security. While the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides the immediate justification, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein. And I think that's what it's really all about. Now, why is this remark important? Well, because the article Rebuilding America's Defenses, which you'll find at www.newamericancentury.org, comes from a little group known as the Project for the New American Century. And who's in the project? Why, men like Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, and, of course, the people we refer to as the neoconservatives or the neocons. There were only 25 of them back in an organization or in that organization in 1997 when they organized and said, we want to have America dominate the world, in essence. And you can read this on their website, 1998. They're writing to President Clinton saying, we've got to go to war with Iraq. Well, now, I thought we went to war with Iraq because of what happened on September 11th, but you see, maybe September 11th happened because they wanted to go to war in Iraq. And I think that if you look very carefully at what the history of the Middle East, you'll find that most of what's happened there has been totally contrived. America has really dominated this for many years. You go back to 1953. The Iranian people had elected a new prime minister. His name was Mossadegh. And the CIA toppled him. And there's no question the CIA toppled Mossadegh. You can read about that in Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. In fact, one of the men instrumental in that was a man named Colonel Schwarzkopf, the father of General Schwarzkopf, who, of course, was involved in the first Gulf War in 1990. And this was back in 1953. But you see, this goes from century, pardon me, from generation to generation. And so we toppled Mossadegh. We brought the Shah to power. Now, it was just about 3 years after that, 4 years after that, when Nasser, who was of course, was in charge of Egypt, seized the Suez Canal. And at that time, of course, instead of backing the British claim to Suez Canal, we backed Nasser, forced the British to back down, and began to pull out as America then was beginning to exert its influence to gain control of that part of the world. 2 years before that, there was an assassin. His name was Saddam Hussein. He worked for the CIA. This story is told in a book called Unholy Babylon, written a decade or more ago. And we have excerpts from this if any of you want to check it out. Saddam Hussein worked for the CIA and was instrumental in trying to assassinate the ruler of Iraq. Well, then, of course, Saddam Hussein moves over into a key position with the Ba'ath Party and is in charge of security there. And then in that very pivotal year of 1979, he comes to power, but let me tell you, nobody comes to power in the Middle East without the full support and permission of our Central Intelligence Agency. 1979 was a pivotal year for events, because that was the year we toppled the Shah of Iran, who had put in power, and replaced him with the Ayatollah Khomeini. Now, at the time, I wondered why in heaven's name would we topple the Shah of Iran? He had the sixth largest military force in the world. He was the mainstay of America's forces in the Middle East, opposing the advance of the Soviets in that area. Why would we topple a friend and bring an enemy to power? We knew exactly what we were doing, but in 1979 it didn't make any sense to me. The following year, of course, the regime of the Ayatollah Khomeini was established in Iran, and, of course, this began the Islamic terrorist movement. This whole idea of the supremacy of Islam, dying for the Prophet, killing the infidels, and the radical form of Islam produced by the Ayatollah Khomeini led directly to the Islamic terrorist movement, the formation of Al-Qaeda a decade later, and, of course, the attack on the World Trade Center. Now, it was in 1979 also that Zbigniew Brzezinski, in response to requests for aid from the Holy Warriors, a small group of radical Islamic fighters in Afghanistan in their effort to overthrow the puppet Soviet regime in Afghanistan, why Zbigniew Brzezinski talked President Carter into beginning massive funding of the effort to evict the Soviets from Afghanistan, knowing full well this would promote a Soviet invasion. Now, this story is all told in the book called The Unholy Wars, and, of course, it's written by James Cooley, who was a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and I think a fairly effective person evaluating what is taking place in that region at that time. So once, of course, the Soviets had invaded, and then we could bring in the CIA, then we could, of course, begin to promote the radical form of Islam. So you had the radical form of Islam being promoted in Iran. And, of course, starting at about 1981, there was a terrorist base there. It was a terrorist base that had a 747 and a 707 there, where they were training Islamic terrorists how to hijack planes so they could crash them into our buildings. What is the source of documentation for that? Why, a book written by a man named Yosef Badansky, who was the in charge of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare. His book, Attack the West, or Attack America in the West, depending upon whether the book was published in England or the United States, tells that story that there was a training base in Iran in 1981, from 1981 to 1983, training terrorists to hijack American planes to crash them into American buildings. Why didn't our American intelligence agencies know that? Well, they did know that. In fact, what they did in response was to collect, as far as I can tell, all copies of that book. It's almost impossible to get anywhere in the United States today because they didn't want the American public to know that they knew back in 1983 that this was the plan to hijack our planes and crash them into our buildings. And you can actually find, if you want to verify what I'm saying, and you can't find the book, of course, in the New Yorker magazine, and I believe it was September 24th, it was the issue, all black issue, that came out right after the September 11th attack. And there, of course, they quote Joseph Podansky and making that statement that in 1981 to 83, they were already planning to hijack our planes and crash them into our buildings. And, of course, our intelligence agencies knew that. They just didn't want the Americans to know that. Well, we've got John. No, we've got Charlotte Isabel on the line.
Hi there. You can stay there with John if you want.
No. I want to talk to you because I'm going to talk to John for the next hour.
Oh,
I'm so glad
okay.
You could be with us.
Well, I am sorry. I left on my workaround phone, so you couldn't get through to me. My husband's going to divorce me, I think, one of these days if I don't learn to turn that thing off when I'm finished talking to people.
All right, fine. Well, I don't want him to divorce you under any circumstances.
Well, these are the very important things that cause divorce.
So, all right, fine. Well,
okay.
Charlotte Isabel is one of our favorite guests. Charlotte worked for the Foreign Service for many years. She was very interested in education. She served in the Reagan White House as a senior analyst and advisor there during the early years of the Reagan administration, where she became aware of the fact that there was a plan to deliberately dumb down our children. She's written a book on the deliberate dumbing down of America, a book which we incidentally happen to carry. And then, of course, now, she's been with us on many occasions talking about the Skull and Bones organization because both her father and her grandfather were in Skull and Bones. And they were probably not in the inner core of this cult organization, but she's got a pretty good grasp that these are the movers and shakers who really rule the United States and then secondarily rule the world. Would that be a fair statement, Charlotte?
Absolutely, yes. It is sort of amazing, isn't it, that a secret club at Yale University would be ruling the world. But I think it's probably true. It looks to me like certainly no other organization has ever been researched to the extent this one has and been found to have such enormous control over policy, I don't think.
Of course, I think it's so interesting that in a nation of 280 million people, the only people we can find to run for the presidency are George W. Bush, who was a member of Skull and Bones, and John Kerry, who was also a member of Skull and Bones, one supposedly a Republican, the other supposedly a Democrat. But they both have exactly the same policies. They'll argue back and forth. They'll call one another names. They'll insult their integrity. The Bushes will talk about Kerry's affairs, and Kerry's people will talk about George Bush's failure to be on duty in the National Guard and, of course, avoiding service during Vietnam. But it's all smoke and mirrors to take us away from the really important issues, our globalization, shipping our jobs overseas, shipping our factories overseas, transferring America's wealth to the rest of the country, allowing the invasion of illegal aliens, and the ultimate destruction of America as we know it.
Well, I think that, you know, it's an insult. They don't care anymore about insulting our intelligence, but it really is an insult to our intelligence to have two individuals from the same order, from the order at Yale, running against one another in the presidential election. I think that it's so blatant they've decided now that this is sort of a little balloon. They have these test balloons. They're flying this balloon to see if the American people will tolerate this. And if we do, then the next thing will be we probably won't even have any elections. You know, I really look at it that way because if we're stupid enough to accept that this is not a conspiracy, having these two guys, both in the secret society. If we're stupid enough to accept that, we'll accept anything.
Well, of course, the Skull and Bones is only one of a number of secret societies.
Right.
I think that people have to understand that John Kerry comes from the Council on Foreign Relations, and although George W. Bush was never asked to join, why his father was a member of the board of directors, and George W. Bush just by chance happened to pick his head of the National Security Council, that is Condoleezza Rice, and his vice president, and his secretary of state, Colin Powell. They all come from the Council on Foreign Relations. And if you go down through the people who make up his cabinet and key positions, you know, the majority of them come from the Council on Foreign Relations. So it really doesn't matter whether you have the Democrats or the Republicans in office. The same policies are always continued, aiming towards a new world order.
That's right.
A new world religion.
Well, I think that, you know, I always go back to Tony Sutton. Dear Tony, I was thinking, what a shame he's not around now, but we really do need him. But he's not. But his book is. And that book, which you have, America's Secret Establishment, An Introduction to the Order, is, as far as I'm concerned, it's just fantastic. It is such a good book. I can never get enough of it. I'm constantly looking at it. But there's this one quote, it's right on the cover, and it just fascinates me. It tells you how very important the order is. And it's a quote from F.O. Matheson, who was Skull and Bones, 1923, to Donald Ogden Stewart, Skull and Bones, 1916, about Matheson's upcoming appearance before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. And what's interesting here is my father went to, not only was it Skull and Bones with Matheson 2 years later, or a good bit later, no, 1 year later, but he also was at Hotchkiss with him, so he knew him. And I knew his daughter in Camden, Maine, when I was on the local school board, and she used to rip me apart publicly, in public, at public functions, privately. A so-called very well healed and established lady, in quotes, and she was such a leftist because her father was, but I didn't realize that until Tony found this quote. Listen to it. This is Matheson talking to Stewart. They're both Skull and Bones members, and Matheson had been called before the House Committee on Un-American Activities, and here is what he said. As long as we have somebody from Bones who can bring pressure on the committee, I should think we'd be all right.
In other words, you bring pressure on the House Committee on activity, so then they'll have somebody there to diffuse it and make sure they never get to the truth.
Yes. I mean, that little quote, I love it. It's right on the cover, and I don't have to go into the book and find anything, but it's quite a book, and secret societies have existed ever since, as you know. I mean, you're an expert on that, and that people have, again, the American people have been conditioned to believe that there is no such thing as conspiracy in the United States, the only country in the history of the world that has conspiracy. I always say, anybody who doesn't believe in conspiracy has never cracked a history book. That must bother the intellectuals enormously, because they're the ones who tell us that there is no such thing as conspiracy.
They've forgotten what Julius Caesar said, et tu, Brute, as he was slumped there after he had been stabbed by this conspiracy of his friends to kill him.
Exactly.
And in fact, there was a conspiracy behind the assassination of President Lincoln, because they hung about four or five people. So there had to be a conspiracy. They weren't hanging innocent people, were they? But
no.
You see, we don't never teach that in our schools.
No, they don't. They don't teach history at all. You know, for this week, a little bit of news, and of course, you guys in California heard it. I mean, Arnold Schwarzenegger's comments about foreigners being able to become president, and his reference to Kissinger and Albright as being models of what we want to have input in this country, that about knocked my socks off.
Yeah, well, certainly that is our conservative president. Pardon me, our conservative governor here in California.
Oh,
I'm sure we got rid of a liberal and got a conservative in.
Well, at least I think a lot of people who went for Schwarzenegger, I hope they read that. I hope a lot of conservatives who thought he was going to be the answer to their prayers. I hope they heard that one.
I think so, too. But I think that really this whole thing is about running Arnold for president sometime in the future.
Yes.
We'll be right back with Charlotte and Ray. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest today is Charlotte Isabey. We're talking about skull and bones. Of course, this is one of a myriad of secret societies, and of course, Charlotte has been referring to a book by Anthony Sutton, Professor Anthony, it's not Anthony, but Anthony Sutton, called The American Establishment, and it's the background of the Skull and Bones. We also carry the book Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Secrets of the Tomb. We actually have a syllabus we put together with the names and history of all of the members of Skull and Bones based upon the book circulated by the Skull and Bones, which we were fortunate enough to get from somebody who had connections with the order. And then, of course, our four-tape set on Skull and Bones, which will give you an entirely different insight into what this organization is about. Now, Charlotte, the Skull and Bones is significant, really, because it influences a lot of other key organizations. Like, what other organizations would you find the members of Skull and Bones in?
Well, it's definitely in the Council on Foreign Relations,
sure,
which you were mentioning, which is not really a secret organization. It's not particularly open to the public, but you can get foreign affairs. They send it to me free. I don't know why they do, but I've been getting it free for years. And you can get their membership list, and they're now on the evening news quite regularly, you know, bringing Henry Kissinger on for the conservative viewpoint, and et cetera. You know, so, but Skull and Bones, they've got people in the State Department, of course, high ups, the Central Intelligence Agency, always, that was their main focus.
And I think that's so important to have their people in the Central Intelligence Agency. In fact, there's even referred to the Bones section of the Skull of the CIA.
Yes, absolutely. And then, of course, my interest has always been education and how education is influenced by foreign policy, really. And you educate children so that they will be comfortable living in this great one-world government that has been planned for us over 200 years. So the education arm, the education end of Skull and Bones is very, very important and has not been dealt with, only by Tony Sutton. And he did his homework, and I think that was when he began to realize that this was a very, very, very important secret society. Right in his book on page 56, he says, the next step is to look at education. Our present educational chaos can be traced to three members of the order, Daniel Coit Gilman, Timothy Dwight, and Andrew Dixon. Gilman imported the experimental psychology of Hegelian physiologist Wilhelm Wundt from Germany. This is what I go after in my book, and even in my little book, basically, Back to Basics Reform, or Skinnerian International Curriculum. That was the shift from the idea that man is a human being with a soul and a conscience and a mind, to man is an animal to be trained, and every single action of man can be measured. He can be conditioned, measured. Outcomes, folks, got it. Performance. You keep hearing that, don't we? But we don't realize that the method that's being put in this country right now, and they've been working on it ever since 1965, basically, to implement it in the public school system, is Wundtian. And it was brought over here. It was brought over from Germany by these people.
Hold that thought for just a moment, Charlotte. We've got to have our... Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Charlotte Isabey, and we've just been talking about where are the people from Skull and Bones today. Well, they're working in the Central Intelligence Agency. They're working within banking. They're working within the upper echelons of our government. They're working in the Council on Foreign Relations. And then, of course, Charlotte is bringing out the fact that it was really the Skull and Bones influence on education that began to transform our educational system from one that was dedicated to teaching facts and reading and writing arithmetic to beginning to control the values, attitudes, and beliefs of our children and shape them into ideal citizens for the planned world government, because this is really what it's all about, this ancient plan of the ancient mystery religions and secret societies to create a one world government, and of course America, our military power and our finances were to lead the world into this wonderful new utopia ruled by the ruling elite. And many of them, of course, would come from Skull and Bones.
That's right, and Sutton's book is very, very comprehensive on this subject. I find myself always talking about Sutton's book instead of my own book. I have a thing about his book. I think it's so very, very important. And if anybody wants to know what we're going to be ending up with, no matter who wins, they've got to get the book. Order it from Stan. You can, you know, when Stan runs out of them, you can order one from me. But anyway, this is important, and it's not that it's the first time that we've had, you know, candidates, both party, who had the same agenda, but it's been going on for ever since, what, the beginning of the last century. That was the plan, as Dr. Stan has told you a million times. That was the plan, to control both parties so that when we go to the polls, we'll think that we're going to have a change, but we won't. And that comes from Carol Quigley, who gave us the whole background to this history and tragedy and hope. He was Bill Clinton's mentor at Georgetown University. So, no, it was not coming out of the mouth of Phyllis Schlafly or Charlotte Isherbeet or Stan Montes. It's coming right out of the mouth of the Bill Clinton's professor.
In fact, at page 1247 and 1248 of his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, he makes that statement, you know, what we need is two congressional parties that are just about the same so the public can throw the rascals out every 4 years. But the domestic and international policies will remain the same. That's what it's really all about. But you want to let the people think that they're going to make a difference. Well, the people can make a difference. There are third-party candidates running out there. We can certainly change Congress, and any congressman who's voted for free trade should be permanently retired, because that, of course, is why they are sending our jobs and our factories overseas. They're not only sending our factories overseas, we're subsidizing them to go. We're giving them special tax breaks to leave America and go over to China, and then they don't have to pay any taxes on the money they make there unless they bring it back. So why would they bring it back here and pay taxes? No, build more factories over in communist China or Malaysia or wherever it will be. And, of course, Americans are still buying the same products manufactured by the same companies. Only those companies are manufacturing them in communist China.
Well, it's, Stan, it's so interesting how the nightly news never explains to the American people why we are in so much trouble economically. Whether it's the, you know, they never relate the loss of jobs to NAFTA and GATT. The mad cow disease, have you heard anything about that? The fact that it was a cow from Canada. They're right. The American people are so dumbed down that they don't have to tell them. They haven't figured that out. And my husband about 6 years ago had a discussion with a doctor across the street who reads nothing but the Wall Street Journal and listen to Rush Limbaugh, and he thinks that he's very well rounded. He really reads a good circle of information, and we shake our head. But he thinks that NAFTA and GATT are just wonderful, and he won't admit even now that there are problems with it. And I remember my husband said, well, you know, Bob, the time is going to come when the Americans are not going to be able to afford the goods from China, etc. And that is exactly what we're looking at now. And he shakes his head and he says, oh, that will never happen. That is happening. That is happening right now. We're going to get ourselves into such a position that the cheap products are going to be too expensive for us.
And not only that, but the jobs are leaving, the good jobs
right.
are leaving. And this is happening intensely. In fact, the head yes. of the Council of Economic Advisors, President's Council, said how wonderful it was, all those jobs going over to India.
Isn't that terrible?
Because now, of course, why they could produce goods so much more cheaply, they could sell them here more cheaply, but he never mentioned that an awful lot of people are not going to be able to buy them because they don't have any jobs. We're
That's
going to be
right.
back here in just a moment or two with Charlotte Isabey. And, of course, when we return, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Charlotte Isabey. And, of course, we're talking about the effect of globalization, which, of course, is the policy of both political parties. But, of course, nobody's going to admit that. Oh, no. Now, of course, Kerry and Edwards are both talking about, you know, how terrible these policies are and how, if they were the president, why they'd make more jobs by... Well, they'd give tax breaks to our corporations to hire American workers, and so we'd give our local industries money to hire their workers and maybe pay for their health care benefits so they'd have more of a tendency to keep their companies here. Well, let me tell you that there's no amount of money they could give these companies to compensate for the fact that they can hire people in China for about 10% of what they can hire them right here in the United States for. People there get $100 a month, and they're glad to have it over here. The average individual, if you're going to live, you've got to make a couple of $1,000 a month. We're just creating a totally impossible situation. Free trade is a great theory, but what it does is transfer the wealth of the country like ours to the other countries. And, of course, China's looking out after their vested interests in the well-being of their people. Our leaders are intent upon transferring our wealth to other countries. Not their wealth, mind you. Not the wealth of the wealthy or the corporations, but the wealth of the middle class. And that's, of course, how you change the demographics of a country. And you create a two-tier system. A group of people, the vast majority, very poor and impoverished, losing their homes, losing their cars, losing their possessions because they can't pay their bills, and then the very, very wealthy. And you don't think that's going to create social unrest in this country. And that's why they know this is going to happen, and that's why FEMA is putting in detention camps. You're told this is in case of civil unrest because of terrorist attacks. No, they know what's going to happen as a result of globalization, in my opinion. Let's hope and pray it never comes to that. What are your thoughts on that, Charlotte?
Well, I think it's all around us now, and one has, there's one word I think people can understand, and this is the old communist dream, was international socialism and redistribution, perestroika, restructuring, redistribution of wealth, redistribution of brains, that's outcome-based education, right? Redistribution of everything, religion. Everything has to be destroyed in order for them to restructure. That's perestroika. This is for the new age, the new world order, world government, Gorbachev's green, you know, the Green Party, the environmental agenda. Everything has to be destroyed in order to be restructured, and right. That, including the Middle East.
Hold that thought for just a moment as we bring our other stations back with us. Okay, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Charlotte Isabey. We've been talking about globalization and the fact that the leaders of both political parties support globalization, the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, the next program will be CAFTA, which will be the Central American Free Trade Organization. And then the plan, at least according to our guest we had on last night, Galen Ross, and I think he's probably right, will be to unite all of the Western Hemisphere into one gigantic trading bloc, into one currency, into one central bank, into one, eventually one government. And when this happens, will come the loss of our constitutional freedom and will raise the living standards of the average American to that of the Guatemalan peasant. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or, here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. If you have a question, if you agree, if you disagree, we'd love to hear from you. But the one point that most people miss is they talk about these insane policies that are being foisted on the American people today is the fact that there are spiritual forces behind this entire movement towards the New World Order. And unless we recognize that, we can't understand anything that's going on today because none of this makes sense. Why would our leaders want to impoverish our people? Why would our leaders want to transfer our industrial base to other countries? And when there is no way that this nation can exist as a first world nation, as a leading world nation, without an industrial base, And yet that industrial base is leaving here. Our electronics is leaving. Our steel is leaving. Much of our automotive is leaving. Certainly our furniture manufacturing is leaving. Our textile manufacturing is leaving. We've put such restrictions on mining that it's very difficult to open mines now with all the environmental protection. We're restricting the harvesting of our timber. And where will our wealth come from? Well, maybe flipping hamburgers in McDonald's. In fact, if you look at the list of jobs that are being created, and Paul Craig Roberts published an article today about that, where are the new jobs coming in America? Janitorial work, nurse's aide, working in hospitals as a technician, working in fast food factories, fast food producers. In fact, somebody suggested we could increase the amount of manufacturing here if we included making hamburgers as manufacturing, because after all, you have to take two pieces of bread and put the hamburger between them and put the mayonnaise on. Isn't that manufacturing a hamburger? And so we can call that a manufacturing job, because we're not going to have many other manufacturing jobs before this is over.
That's true. I mean, I've got a nephew who's been trying to find a job, and we've all been looking for him. He's back and forth across the country, and he can't find a job. And, of course, he's had problems, his own problems. But still, when you're trying to help someone, you start reading and recognizing that there's a severe problem here. I mean, I remember the New York Times had a magazine section about a year ago where this fellow who had been making $300,000 a year in a company he'd worked for 23 years, he got fired, and he was selling blue jeans at Gap. He'd been trying very hard to get another job. So what you're talking about is absolutely correct. Well, what we're doing is we're the United States is being brought down to the level of a third world country. All countries, this is the same thing for everywhere. We're all going to be equally miserable. This is the socialist communist plan for international socialism, and as you said, it's been set up for many years, create the regions first, and you had a speaker on last night, I guess, who was discussing this. I discuss it all the time. I write about it. There are a lot of articles on my website which deal with this, deliberatedumbingdown.com, not just on education, but on the on Gorbachev, on the new Soviet Union, the European Union that Gorbachev calls the new European Soviet. That's a very outspoken comment. He said on June 17th, not on June 17th, but in May of 2002, Bush actually addressing the Bundestag said, "The dreams of centuries is close at hand. When you integrate your markets and share a currency in the European Union, you are creating the conditions for security and common purpose. In all these steps, Americans do not see a rival, but rather the success of our allies, and we applaud your progress." Then he goes on, he says, "Another mission we share is to encourage the Russian people to find their future in Europe and with America. A new Russian-American partnership is being forged. A Russian colonel now works on the staff of U.S. Army General Tommy Franks, commander of the war in Afghanistan." And the president proudly noted that following his summit in Moscow, he and heads of state from other NATO countries would travel to Rome to meet as equal partners with President Putin. And he goes on and on and on. And if people don't understand these quotes, I don't know what they do. Maybe they think it's okay. They think communism is dead. It is not dead. It's more alive than ever. We're implementing it in our country right now. And if you go to my website, deliberatedumbingdown.com, you will find my article that deals with that. It's called "No American Left Alone" instead of "No Child Left Behind." This is a kindergarten through age 80 agenda. That's what the National Alliance of Business calls it, folks. Kindergarten through age 80.
Now you're talking about lifelong learning. You're talking about this new program for education. And since a lot of people are going to lose their jobs, they're going to have to go back to school and be retrained.
Right. Through age 80, though. They were talking about community education, which has been in the works for about at least 50 or 60 years. You're talking about block captains. You're talking about community-oriented policing. We have an agreement with, I like to call it the Soviet Union, with the KGB. Louis Freeh signed an agreement with the KGB in the early 90s. which is the community-oriented policing system. This has been going on while the American people have been, reduced to both of them having two jobs, not being able to really understand anything, even if they have access to it, because they're so busy trying to raise their children. The church, whatever religion that one is involved in, is under attack, because that has to happen as well. I have an interesting paper in my files that I want to type up one of these days. Everybody keeps after me for it. On the change in religion by Harlan Cleveland. You know that name, Stan. Very, very important internationalist with the Aspen Institute, et cetera, UN. He's probably around 90 now. And I knew him because I worked right next door to him in Brussels in 1963. Harlan Cleveland is certainly a socialist. I would say certainly world government. But he and this Flemish professor, drew up a paper that was published by the European Union about 4 years ago on what had to be done in regard to religion. It's quite a paper. It's not that long, and I've got to type it up and put it on the internet. And it's very clear that they have to get rid of the traditional religions. And that means no more right or wrong. Everybody makes up their own mind of what's right or wrong. No real God. God is within us. All this stuff. And that's very important because he has all the way through, Harlan Cleveland, he was our first ambassador to the common market before it was the European Union. So it gives you an idea where he's coming from. And this is what we're looking at. Regional government, regional world government, regionalism is communism. And I have that great quote from Mr. Zeitlin, in the Communist Daily World in the mid-70s, calling for regional government in the United States. We weren't moving fast enough. How well it had worked in the Soviet Union. The people out there, the planners and all, who some of them, they don't even know what they're doing. They haven't read the history of regional government. They wouldn't know who Joe Hindman, a great scholar on the subject, who wrote 1313 Revisited and Blame Metro. They wouldn't know who these people are. I have a good article, I got it published just recently in our local paper here, which is a sort of a major paper because we've got Bowdoin University and we've got Brunswick Naval Air Station and we have the Bath Iron Works that build ships. And they did put an article that I wrote on regional government. It was in this week, and I'm very pleased because I explained to people exactly what it is. And the link with the International Union of Local Governments, which I mentioned to you before, Stan, where they're going to be hooking our local communities directly into the UN. We're not going to be going through Washington anymore, or through my old office in the Department of Education, which had the link. Right. We're going to be going directly from our local communities, zap, into the UN.
Well, as Murray Strong said in a book he recently wrote, think globally, but act locally. And
that's
so
right.
The whole idea is control things locally, set up your system of local commissars, establish your police force, mm-hmm. and, of course, control the people, and then link them on. Well, let's go to Mike, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. One question about, I know lots of people are out looking for work and they're losing their jobs and all, but what is holding real estate prices up?
All right, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I think it's the low interest rate.
Yeah, it's the low interest rate. Yeah. It's the policies of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Yeah.
And, of course, if you've been following the Wall Street Journal the last few days, Alan Greenspan has said, we've got to rein this thing in because they're creating a real estate bubble that just isn't going to quit. And when this thing pops, there's going to be real problems.
It is. They must have, well, I don't know whether they have nightmares or not, but I'll tell you what we do. We bought our house here in Bath, Maine for $200,000 and 10 years ago, and I just found out that it's been listed from someone else. We're not selling it, but at $525. How do you ever?
It's all phony, Mike. What you're doing is creating artificial prosperity for a lot of people. A lot of people, they've got a house. They bought it for $40,000. It's now worth $400,000.
Right.
They're borrowing money on that. They're buying a new car.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just spending this money And one of these days, when this bubble pops, why they're going to owe $300,000 on a house that'll only sell on the open market for $100,000, they're going to walk away from it. You're going to see a complete collapse, but it's going to maybe take a year or 2 years, but it's coming just as sure as God made little green apples.
And it'll be very sad for those who really don't own their houses. The government has convinced Americans by saying it over that we own our houses. Well, we don't own them as long as we have a mortgage.
So this right? is all artificial, Mike. And but you must understand that they cannot let things collapse before November, because the last thing they want is for the American people to realize that both political parties are controlled by the same people. Why they might even vote for a third party if they realize that maybe we need a second party. Because we have two parties that are really both the same, and then, of course, what we need is a real second party to represent the best interests of the American people.
That's right. We really have. It's sort of like in the Soviet Union. Remember they used to say they had sort of free elections?
Right.
Well, there's no difference between their system and ours, except ours is a little more cleverly disguised because of the outfits like the CFR and the Skull and Bones and all that control our government. The media here is totally controlled, far more than in Europe. Which is supposed to, not have, the freedoms that we have. We have a much more controlled media. They said we have freedom of speech in this country. You just read an article in the Washington Times in regard to that rancher who was picked up by the police in Nevada, and the policeman took his identification and arrested him. With no reason, and that was very interesting. I've written a little article that will be published in News with Views in a few days. The same thing happened here. Now we're getting into a discussion of the Patriot Act and the totalitarian system being implemented. A good friend of ours was walking between Wiscasset, Maine, and Bath around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, coming down to our place for dinner. I guess people aren't meant to walk anymore. And he was dressed nicely and everything, and a police car comes zipping up behind him with sirens screeching and everything, and stops, scares him half to death, asks for his identification. And this guy's been around enough to know that it's just as well to give the policeman his driver's license. Also, he wanted to get to our house for dinner, and he did. I wouldn't have. I would have said politely, officer, have I done something wrong? Well, the officer made him get in the car, said get in the squad car, and he made a call and checked with headquarters regarding the driver's license and got a message back about 3 minutes. Okay, no problem with this guy. Well, wait a minute. This is probably going on all over, because I thought maybe this was unusual, the one instance that I knew of personally. You know it's true when it happens to you. But then I read about this in the Washington Times. So if Americans are going to accept this, that we're very close to Nazi Germany.
Well, of course, the thing is, Charlotte, that people really believe they've got this terrible danger of terrorism.
Oh, yeah.
They're playing this up. They're going from yellow to orange. They're telling us that any moment we may have another terrorist attack. Basically, we gutted the whole terrorist movement in this country immediately after 9/11 when we arrested those 1,200 Muslims, and many of them are still held. That was the terrorist network in the United States, I'm firmly convinced. Well, let's go to Gary, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Gary. Question or comment?
Yeah, good evening. A lot of people I hear talking about saying, because the annual report, the Foreign Affairs is out there, that the Council on Foreign Relations is not secret. And Galen Ross in his Who's Who of America blasts that one out of the water. The annual report in 20 different places, and he's got it in here as conditions, express conditions for membership, that they cannot disclose grounds for termination, any characterization of statements, any publisher speakers in attributed form to a newspaper or radio station, if it's published in a public medium where there's substantial risk for being circulated or published. It goes on, and they're subject to, like you said, termination or suspension. So I think the Council on Foreign Relations truly is secret with a lot of their mechanisms. They're certainly, you see them on the, physically on the TV and so forth, but their activities, their internal structure, when they get together and make their when they get together to conspire, those are secret.
Well, I really think that the thing about the Council on Foreign Relations is I don't think the average member of the Council on Foreign Relations really understands what it's all about. I think that he's a liberal, and he's flattered to be part of this elite group, and of course he's told that, you know, he's on the inside, he's going to have a briefing from the Secretary of State or the President, or maybe he's going to have Gorbachev come and visit them. But there is an inner core of this group, as with all of the secret groups, that really knows what it's all about.
I think a lot of that might have been true 15, 20 years ago, but with all the scores of books on the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Internet is just combed with enough regular information that somebody that joins that organization, I no longer give them the benefit. I don't think they deserve it anymore.
All right, fine. Well, thanks very much for your opinion.
You betcha.
Bye-bye. Okay, this is Dr. Stan. We'll be back in just a moment with Charlotte Isabey and wrap up the first hour of tonight's program on Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening has been Charlotte Isabey. Let me just make one brief comment in reference to what was said by our last caller, Gary. And that is, of course, there are lots of books written on the Council on Foreign Relations. But only one of them that I know, or two possibly, are going to tell you the origin of the Council on Foreign Relations. The true origin, it came out as a front group for the Round Table, which was a front for the secret society that Cecil Rhodes created in 1891 to create a new world order and a new world religion. And of course, this was founded in the occult. And we cover that in my book, Tragedy, my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. But the source of reference would be Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, a History of the World in Our Time, pages 941 and 942. So if you want to get that book and determine whether what I'm telling you is true or not, you need to. And yet, of course, the Council on Foreign Relations provides every Secretary of State, all but one CIA, Director of the CIA, and every Chairman of the Federal Reserve System. This is a very powerful organization. Charlotte, what would be your parting thoughts for our listeners this evening? Charlotte, are you
still
there?
Yes, I am. That question, every time you ask me that question, I have a problem with it, because I think we've got to hang in together, all of us who are not part of the controlled right and the left, and we have to perhaps be a little bit more open to liberals who are very concerned about the loss of our freedoms. Not automatically cutting them out of the dialogue because they may disagree with us on other issues. And eventually, somehow, we're going to have to form not a real organization which can be infiltrated, because any organization can, but some sort of a loose network on the Internet where we can have some sort of a voice in bringing about a return to constitutional principles. That's the only way, and through prayer.
Amen to that. Well, we're going to have to do both those things. And of course, that's what we do here.
Yes.
And we, of course, enjoy having you on as a regular guest, Charlotte. And what we really need, of course, is to get that fellow across the street from you listening, and people all across America, and get them re-educated to understand that socialism is an elitist concept, the redistribution not of the elitist wealth, but of the wealth of the middle class. Hey, we're out of time. God bless you. Thanks so much for staying up and being with us tonight.
Thank you, Stan. Take care.
I will. Good night, and God bless you.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Okay, that was Charlotte Isabey, her website, deliberatedumbingdown.com. Well, Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we've got to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. Let me just give you that website. It's deliberatedumbingdown.com for Charlotte Isabey. And you go up there. Of course, we do carry her book. But she's got lots of other fascinating things you'll certainly want to see. Deliberatedumbingdown.com. But this is the time we need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent on those of you who listen to our programs, who are hopefully becoming educated and beginning to understand that this plan for a world government is as old as time itself. Plato wrote about this 2,350 years ago in his book, The Republic, and that, of course, is almost the prototype for things going on today. This idea of a plutonic world society, a ruling elite, a massive police force, a doing away with the family, the children belong to the state, and all women belong to all men. It's true sexual freedom. Well, what a horrible thing this would be. This is the antithesis of everything we believe in, of freedom under God. But, of course, Plato was deeply tied into the mystery religions. It was strongly tied into the mystery religions, as was, of course, his teacher, Socrates, as was his student, Aristotle and Alexander the Great. And if you haven't read my, I guess it was my January newsletter going into the background of that Alexander the Great and Aristotle, you really need to get that. If any of you would like to get a free copy of our newsletters, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll be glad to send you a copy. Of course, we hope that you will give serious consideration to either subscribing or joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, which, of course, helps us. As 5 hours a day, we reach out on shortwave and on Internet, 4 hours a day on shortwave, 5 hours a day on the Internet at www.radioliberty.com. Shortwave, this station you're listening to, 5.745 megahertz. And you out there in the listening audience, your job is to try to encourage people to listen to our programs. And that's how we build up the listening audience on our afternoon programs. And we've got an excellent listening audience there, to the shortwave and Internet in the afternoon. And we need the same thing in the evening, because now we'll be able to get the people here on the west coast of the United States. And more people are beginning to understand what's really going on. This great scam that's been played on the American people as we send our boys overseas to fight in wars that have fought for entirely different reasons than the American people are being told. The reason for all the wars of the last century, starting with the Spanish-American War and then the Boer War in South Africa, the First World War and the Second World War, and Korea and Vietnam, it was all about the New World Order, the New World Religion, and that's what this is all about, the current war that we're fighting in the Middle East. It's all about long-term planning for the New World Order. If you'd like to get a copy of my latest newsletter, that's the February newsletter, we go into the background of how this all came about and how they talked the American people into really believing that we had to go to war in Iraq. Well, we hope that many of you will want to get our video diapracts, the story of the church growth movement, that's diapracts, the video Megiddo, the March to Armageddon, my video, The Brotherhood of Darkness, my video, Iraq, The Untold Story, my video, 9-1-1 Contrived, and then, of course, so many of the books that we carry, The New World Order, The Ancient Plan of Secret Societies by William Still, my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. We'll give you insights into what's going on and the secret societies operating behind the scenes, who's in the secret societies and the documentation for what we say. And so you'll be able, of course, to recognize the symbols, the emblems that they hide everywhere in plain sight. Well, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers. We ask you to pray for revival. But we also ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war. America is under attack today. Until tomorrow evening at the same time, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Now, we welcome your calls all across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But right now, of course, we're waiting for John Spring to come. And John has his own radio program in Southern California, heard, I believe, every Sunday evening. And John is a geographer. And, of course, geographers really do more than just study geography. They look at the geopolitics and, of course, what's really happening in the country, not only as far as the layout of the country, but what is transpiring in that country and the part that that country plays in the affairs of surrounding countries. John Spring, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Dr. Stan, to be on your program.
Now, what day is it? Sunday that your program is heard there in Southern California?
That is correct. Every Sunday, Dr. Stan, at 4 p.m. on K-SPA, which is 1510 on the AM dial.
Okay, that's wonderful. Well, I'm so glad that you're at least maintaining a voice down there, because there are not that many conservative, truly conservative voices down there anymore, are there?
Not as many as we had in the past. We're hoping that George Putnam may be joining us shortly, but... I don't want to say anything further till I know that it's definite.
All right, fine. Now, of course, the station you were on before, what was that, sold and went over to Spanish-speaking? What happened?
It appears that the Carnegie Endowment for Peace helped to finance the purchase of that station by a corporation which was planning to have a Spanish-speaking format instead of English-speaking. And so that more or less made it impossible for us to stay on that station.
All right, fine. Well, I remember one time when I first got started in radio, I didn't know too much about radio, and so I got onto a shortwave station. It had just the most wonderful outreach, but the trouble is it was primarily Spanish-speaking, and I was, of course, English-speaking, and so there was nobody listening to the program when I came on. Everybody was Spanish-speaking, and we did pick up a few listeners over a period of 6 months, but you suddenly realize that you've got to be on the sort of station where people will be listening because they want to hear this sort of programming. They'll want to hear the people before you, and then they'll want to hear the people after you. And if you're sandwiched in between, they'll listen to you, and eventually they'll come to like your program so much that they'll listen primarily for what you have to say as well.
Yes. I just caught the tail end of the last hour on shortwave. I have a portable shortwave that was able to bring you in without the need for an additional antenna.
How did it sound?
Quite good, I thought. The reception was quite good here in Southern California.
Well, now all we've got to do is get about 7 million people down there to get shortwave sets and start listening.
Yes, and in the case of my radio station, they're going to need additional antennas to pick us up, because we're only at up to 10,000 watts instead of 50,000 watts or 20,000 watts as we were at nighttime on the other station. So.
Right, well, how far will that 10,000-watt station spread?
Well, it'll take us throughout all of the Inland Empire and a good share of Orange County and a small portion of L.A. County, but hopefully within the very near future we will be authorized to send our signal to the L.A. Basin, so our audience would increase considerably.
Well, we hope so, and we wish you well in your endeavor. Well, you wanted to talk this evening, what about Taiwan? What subjects did you want to cover?
Well, I thought we might start briefly with Taiwan and then perhaps touch a little bit about the area of Central Asia and the Middle East, and maybe even Latin America.
All right, fine. Well, this lead off, where do you want to start?
Well, let's start with Taiwan. I had the opportunity to speak with a mutual friend of ours, Stephen W. Mosier of the Population Research Institute. And he still believes very strongly that there's a possibility, as I do, that The People's Republic of China has intentions to control and take over China, but...
Taiwan, you're speaking of.
I'm sorry, Taiwan. And Beijing seems to still have this very strong desire, but I was somewhat shocked to find out that his scenario is a little bit more shocking than mine, in that he believes if the opportunity avails itself, that the Chinese communists on the mainland will not hesitate to launch as many as 500 missiles, although I think they have a much larger number in their inventory pointed towards Taiwan, to basically disengage all of their infrastructure, and even though that this would result in the deaths of many of the Taiwanese. It seems as if life has very little value for the Chinese government. And you can understand his perspective in that I think it's generally every Friday night in the stadiums there are mass executions. I think every year the Chinese execute more people than the rest of the world combined, which is a fairly large number. So that's one aspect that I found a little shocking, even from my standpoint, because I thought the Chinese would be a little bit more inclined to take somewhat of a more pragmatic position by attempting to have a naval blockade surrounding that island nation, which is very dependent upon raw materials and food from outside sources. But I still believe that the year 2005 is a possibility for two reasons. First of all, the Chinese leaders have stated several years ago that they intend to have control of Taiwan by that year. And secondly, we are going to have a general election in November of 2004, which would mean by early 2005 we will possibly have a new administration. We might have a new administration. And that might enable the Chinese communists to think that there's an opportunity for them to take control of Taiwan.
Well, I think John and I, of course, have no inside information on this. I think the Chinese will be more circumspect. I think as long as they need our financial support, as long as America is still a major military and economic force, that they certainly will not act. Now, I don't think that America is going to be a major economic force much longer. Right now, we are the greatest debtor nation in the world, the greatest debtor nation the world has ever seen.
Yes,
we're having to borrow about $1.5 to $1.7 billion every day. And a great deal of that is coming from a communist China and from Japan. We're dependent upon their buying our debts to keep our nation afloat. And I think that probably, perhaps in by the year 2005, we will no longer be able to stand up to anybody, because if we were to challenge China for their military activities, they would say, we're just going to pull all of our money out of your country. And of course we can say, well, we'll just freeze your money, and they'll say, fine, we just won't invest anymore, and you are just going to collapse internally. So I think America is going to lose its ability to be relevant in the rest of the world within a relatively short period of time. There's no incidence where
yes.
a great nation has spent itself into prosperity, and that's just exactly what our leaders are intent upon doing. Either that, or they're intent upon destroying the effectiveness of our military and of our economy, and I think they're working on both very, very well. I think that they're cutting back on our military progressively, depending it more and more on small special forces units, but you're not going to be able to fight a nation that can field an army of 3 or 4 or 5 million people with a few thousand special forces units, no matter how much Mr. Rumsfeld might like to do that.
That's so true, Dr. Stan. And I might add that not too many Americans are aware of the fact that China is in the finance business here in the United States. They have invested in bonds such as household loans. Many people who are now buying a home and having it financed through a mortgage company are unaware that loan might be indirectly financed through the People's Republic of China, through their purchases of loans, through some of the so-called more reputable and well-known loan organizations. And, of course, they've invested very heavily in Wall Street. Many of the Fortune 500 companies have heavy investments from China. And, of course, many of our pension plans are investing heavily now in China as well. Recently I heard that there are some shareholders of Disney Company, the Walt Disney Company, that are asking the shareholders of Disney to vote for some measures that would recognize some human rights issues regarding China's labor policies. But for some strange reason, well, it's not really strange at all, but the board of directors of Disney opposes these and recommends that the shareholders vote against such measures. But could it have anything to do with the fact that they're attempting to build a new Disneyland park over in Hong Kong, which of course is now part of Red China?
Well, you know, I think, John, that things are not as they appear at all. I believe that there are secret agreements, and there have been, between the real leaders of America and the real leaders of China, going back to the time of the Second World War, going back to the time when we put the arms embargo on Chiang Kai-shek and yes. ensured that Chairman Mao would come to power during that period of the Korean War, where we put the 7th Fleet between Formosa and the mainland, not to protect Formosa from the Chinese communist attack, but to protect China's communist China from an attack from Formosa. And that's all covered in the book of Reminiscences by General MacArthur, or Major General Courtney Whitney's book, MacArthur, His Rendezvous with History. And that when we put the American fleet between Formosa and the mainland, we released two large Chinese armies so that they could go up and cross the Yellow River and kill our boys in Korea. Now, how did the Chinese communist leaders know that we would not pull our fleet out and leave their coast bare and open to attack? Well, there were secret agreements.
Yeah.
Just as General Lin Piao is quoted in both of the books I just cited, MacArthur's Rendezvous with History and MacArthur's Reminiscences, General Lin Piao was quoted as saying, and he was the commander of the Chinese Communist forces that crossed the Yalu and slaughtered our prisoners, I would never have risked my troops and my military reputation and crossed the Yalu if I had not been guaranteed that Washington yes. would restrain General MacArthur from retaliating against my lines of supply. So there were secret agreements that General MacArthur didn't know about, and I believe that there are secret agreements still going on today, because I believe that there are secret organizations that work behind the scenes that the average person has no glimpse of at all, because nothing going on makes any sense today. Why, why in our wildest dreams would we be doing everything we can to build up communist China, to build up the greatest potential military enemy we could ever have? And yet we're doing everything to build up their military potential, to build up their economic potential, to build up the stability of their society. This doesn't make sense if you look at it logically, but then there's very little logical going on in the world today.
This is so true. It was not so many decades ago when I expressed an interest in studying China to one of the few specialists in China that I could come across at one of the universities that I was attending. And he said to me at the time, John, the reason that America is showing so little interest in China is that basically China has nothing to sell us. And, of course, the Chinese can ill afford to buy hardly anything from us at this time. But that was 40 years ago. But what has happened since then, the Department of State and the People's Republic of China more or less established an agreement whereby we, through the multinational corporations, would establish facilities in areas designated as special economic zones along China's coast, which could be very closely controlled by the People's Republic of China government. so that they could send their select personnel that they trusted into these areas to be trained by American technicians and educators to operate these facilities and produce quality goods that basically would compete on the open market, and in turn many of our plants here in the United States, many of the European plants in Europe were shut down, and these products are now made in China. And for some reason, it's hard to wonder how this came about, but I think you explained very well just a few moments ago that there have been secret agreements that have been made basically since the time that President Nixon had his so-called goodwill visit with Chairman Mao.
Well, even more than that, there was a wonderful article that appeared in the New York Times in August of 1973, and it's quoted in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and in Dr. Dennis Cuddy's book, Secret Records Revealed. And David Rockefeller had taken a trip to China. Now, David Rockefeller, as you know, is a graduate of the London School of Economics, or had attended that, hardline socialist, the number one leader of the Rockefeller family. Why would he be a socialist? Because he understands socialism, and he understands communism. It's really a power structure by which a small group rules the masses. So in 1973, after traveling through China, and by this time Chairman Mao had already killed probably between 40 and 80 million of his own people, establishing his ruthless tyranny, David Rockefeller writes in this editorial for the New York Times, and I don't have the entire text, but what he concludes by saying is, the social experiment in China, under the direction of Chairman Mao, is one of the most important and successful in history. The social experiment in China, under the director or leadership of Chairman Mao, is one of the most important and successful in history. It was all a social experiment. We brought communism to China
by,
of course, putting an arms embargo on Chiang Kai-shek so that there was no war over there. We just turned China over to the communists, and then they had this great social experiment. And, of course, they had a very orderly society by 1973. And if anybody got out of line, they simply took them out, tortured them, and killed them. And that's, of course, David Rockefeller. As he said, well, of course, there may be a few extremes, but... And then, of course, praising Chairman Mao. So the elite in America have never seen anything wrong with the oppression of the people. Now, of course, we're trying a new phase of this social experiment where we will try to motivate people by offering them wealth or prosperity or goods that they can buy with the money that they can make in this sort of free enterprise system that they have that is directed from the top. In other words, there's a certain amount of economic freedom, but no personal freedom in communist China today. Yeah. Would that be a fair statement?
Very fair statement. Very accurate statement. In fact, some of the things you were alluding to earlier, I believe, were also mentioned in your book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. But that's going back a little bit into our conversation. But you're so accurate in what you've just stated, Dr. Stan. I find it strange that the American people have not yet awakened to this situation, why our government and why our leadership... is not aware of it, but you've made a very profound statement.
Well, the reason that the average person is unaware of it is because the media is most probably as tightly controlled in the United States today as it is in communist China. You just don't get the truth from almost any of the major outlets. Certainly we have alternative radio, we have the internet, so at least there's some people who begin to understand what's going on. But the average individual lives in his own little make-believe world where everything is fine, nothing bad will ever happen, but of course that's really not true. And our job, of course, is to break through that that web of intrigue, this web of disinformation, and
yes,
try to get people to think. And we're going to take a quick break here, and when we get back, of course, we'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is John Spring, and John has his own radio program in Southern California. We're talking about what's going on, our relationship with China, and this incredible fact that we're not only encouraging our companies to go to China, and we're lending them money in many instances to build their factories there. We are, of course, subsidizing them by special tax laws so that they don't have to pay taxes on the money they make in communist countries or other countries throughout the world. Why would we do something this stupid unintentionally? And I believe that our leaders know exactly what they're doing. But I think the last thing in the world is they don't want us to know. I think we are building up the best enemy money can buy in preparation for the coming war. I hope I'm wrong. What are your thoughts, John?
Well, I feel that you're right, Dr. Stan. Today I was sort of reminiscing of things that occurred in America during and before the Second World War, at least in terms of the U.S. involvement. I was rather young at the time, but for some reason I had a fairly good memory and was fairly much aware as to what was going on even prior to Pearl Harbor, and considering the fact that I had not turned three until March of 42, that's rather remarkable in a sense. But
yes, I was about 11 at the time, and I can remember things, but I don't remember much when I was three. Go ahead.
But I do recall, for example, some rather strange phenomena that I don't think the average citizen here in Southern California was aware of. For example, I was aware of the barrage balloons that were placed near the vicinity of what is now LAX. I was aware of soldiers guarding that particular area with barbed wire barriers between the beachhead of Playa del Rey and the sand dunes in that particular area. And I also recall that in driving by some of the defense plants, especially closer towards Long Beach, such as Douglas and some of the other aerospace industries of that era, that on top of these buildings were actually fabricated neighborhoods of homes, garages, lawns, trees, to make it look as if it was just part of the suburban community, when in reality beneath this facade were some of the most strategic aircraft plants in Southern California. And for these things to have existed at that time would strongly suggest that there was a good possibility that our enemy at that time in the Pacific could reach our coast and do damage to us. So, but for some reason, I never heard this publicized at all.
And well, of course, was this a real threat, or was this sort of like it is today when we go from yellow to orange? Were they playing games with us? I'm old enough to remember the air raid sirens going off at night, and I can remember sitting on the front steps of our little house in Oakland,
yes,
and seeing the searchlights piercing the sky and hearing that wail of the air raid sirens. And I think they were simply scaring us to death, is my opinion looking back on it. They had people go out and collect all sorts of metal pans and all these things for the war effort. And they restricted our ability to get butter and sugar. And they had plenty of it. But they had to give us the impression we were all involved in this war. We'll be right back here with John. And, of course, what people do not remember from the Second World War is that they had these special divisions that were working on psychology. How do you manipulate the general public? And there were people like William Polley, who eventually would form CBS, working for the OSS and these special think tanks. How do you get the people behind the war? How do you get them mobilized? How do you get them to be willing to pay the taxes? How do you send their sons overseas to fight and bleed and suffer and die in a war? Well, of course, if the average American knew that American corporations had built up Adolf Hitler, American banks had financed Adolf Hitler, that we had known the attack was coming on Pearl Harbor, and, of course, would have withheld information from the commanders at Pearl Harbor and left those boys there to die. If the public had known the truth about the Second World War, why, of course, there would have been rioting in the streets, but they were never allowed to know, and they were all frightened to death. Oh, the Japanese may attack. And there was a Japanese, once or twice, Japanese submarines would surface over the, lob a couple of shells into the, on the coast, or the Japanese sent some balloons over with, to start fires in the forest. But we were never under any serious attack because, of course, after the Battle of Midway, while the Japanese fleet was fairly well destroyed in the Battle of the Coral Sea. In fact, for the last 6 months of the war, the Japanese were trying to surrender. We wouldn't let them surrender. And anybody who doubts that, we have the article out of the Chicago Tribune in June of 1945, the very day that they signed the peace agreement on the Missouri and the harbor in Tokyo. And, of course, they point out the Japanese have been trying for almost 6 months to surrender, and we wouldn't let them. So the invasion of Okinawa and Iwo Jima, dropping of the bombs, totally unnecessary, but it sure did kill an awful lot of people, because that's what it was really all about, a maximum amount of slaughter so people would be willing to do anything, of course, to have this world government. And we had to have that image of the mushroom cloud to give us this feeling we had to have a world government. And I feel that sounds very, very crass, but I think that's the reality of what happened. The Germans had tried to surrender repeatedly, and we wouldn't let them surrender either. And we were dropping firebombs. We killed 100,000 people in Dresden in one or two nights. Same thing in Tokyo. The average American doesn't know that. Totally unnecessary. But, of course, it certainly was very destructive, and that's what war is all about. It's killing people and destroying things.
Yes, Dr. Stan, I agree with you entirely about what you said regarding Germany and Japan and the demand for a so-called unconditional surrender, which resulted in the deaths of thousands, if not millions, of civilians unnecessarily. But unfortunately, the powers to be at that time wanted to create a situation whereby we would almost overwhelmingly want to approve of the United Nations, which, of course, came about in 1945 when the U.S. Senate did ratify approval of the U.N. organization. So you are right, and I agree with you 100%. The bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were completely unnecessary, and yet it goes against everything that we hear about in the news media. But my point to be made earlier was this, Dr. Stan. I felt early on in the war there was a viable threat which had been suppressed by our government. There was complete censure of our newspapers. There was one alleged aerial attack which was heavily censored. And even to this day, most of the old-timers who think they're fairly knowledgeable of this phenomena seem to think that it was just a distortion or an exaggeration. But Dr. Stan, I can tell you from personal experience, and having paid very close attention to the skies as a youngster, even to this day, I can still differentiate between the sound of a vintage World War II Japanese fighter aircraft, such as the Mitsubishi Zero, and a Lockheed P-38 or a Curtiss Corsair, whatever make you might be discussing, because there is a distinct difference. And unfortunately, it's very difficult for people to understand my experience as a youngster, but you have to understand that every day, just like clockwork, Lockheed would send a test flight of a P-38 from Burbank into the air, and it would fly right over our home in Los Angeles.
Right. Well, of course, but you didn't hear any Japanese planes flying over there, did you?
Very, very few.
All right.
Very few.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to take a quick break here, and when we get back, we'll invite your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. If you'd like documentation on anything that I've said, why, give us a call, and we'll be glad to tell you where you can get it, or anything that John has said as well. But, of course, we're talking about the very real communist and the growing communist threat today. Why are we subsidizing it? Doesn't make sense, does it?
No, it doesn't.
It's almost like we're creating the best enemy our own money can buy. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is John Spring. We're talking about, well, what do you want to go ahead anymore with this, or did you want to get into your concern about what's happening in South America or elsewhere?
Well, I think we should spend a few moments on South America. That's a topic that you and I have not discussed on the air together for quite some time. But due to the fact that our politicians in Washington are planning to have us enter an agreement with the rest of the nations of Latin America, called the so-called Free Trade Area for the Americas, or the FTAA, I think we need to take just a little glimpse as to what we might be getting into. Basically, when we erase tariffs and barriers to trade with Latin America, we must understand that we are dealing essentially with third world nations which have an economy much less than ours, and whenever you have free trade agreements or so-called free trade agreements, many bodies cross borders or borders become invalid to more or less control one's sovereignty. And this is one aspect that we really do not understand at present time, and that is so many people from South America and Central America, as well as Mexico, would be able to come to the United States with very little restriction. And unfortunately, there are many terrorist operations occurring now in Central and South America that most Americans are unaware of. Most Americans are not aware of what's really going on in Venezuela with the current Chavez regime, which is very closely tied in with Fidel Castro, supplying him with oil at a very low price. We're unaware of the fact that there are several groups from the Middle East also operating throughout South America. And
are you speaking of Al-Qaeda?
I'm speaking about Al-Qaeda and also some of the other organizations sponsored by Iran and...
like Hezbollah and Hamas, huh?
Exactly.
All right.
Yes. And they have been operating in Central America for quite some time.
Now, are they working more or less in Colombia, where the drug war is going on, or whereabouts?
They're operating in Colombia.
Hold that thought for just a moment while I station to join. Okay, fine. Our guest is John Spring, and he's saying that he is concerned about Latin America, first of all, because Chavez in Venezuela is working very closely with Fidel Castro. They are both hardline communists. And then he's also comments that there are elements of Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah and Hamas operating in South America as well. And he was saying that they seem to be operating in Colombia, where you're having the drug wars going on. And, of course, they would just love to tap into that drug money for their own operations. Why don't you pick up the story from there, John?
Well, Dr. Stem, my main concern is that Americans become aware of what we're getting into if indeed we sign on to the FTAA. Most Americans think, well, this will bring about better relations with South America to improve their economies, but it's basically a one-way street. It is not going to improve our economy. We're probably going to further diminish our economy to their level because there's very... it's hardly possible for their economy to boost ours because they're impoverished nations. They're very much in debt. They're very unstable. They have very little to provide us with in terms of strengthening our economy. So our economies will here in America will diminish considerably if this so-called free trade area for the Americas is passed by Congress.
And I certainly agree with you, John. But they will try to use this this lie that they did with Mexico. Gee, if we just signed this treaty with Mexico, NAFTA treaty, look at all those Mexicans down there. There are 100 million Mexicans. They can all begin buying American products. Well, they knew that the Mexicans didn't have any money to buy our products with, but they sold the American people on a lie. We took down our border with Mexico. We had a positive balance of trade with Mexico before NAFTA. Soon we had a negative balance of trade with Mexico, and of course this began this downward spiral where today we have literally a $500 billion worldwide a negative balance of trade, and not only that, a $500 billion of debt that we're mounting up, increasing every day. But I'm sure you're absolutely right, John. They're going to lie to us. They're going to say, oh, won't it be wonderful? We'll be able to sell goods to all those people in Brazil and in Chile and in Peru and in Argentina. Oh, we've got to have this open trade. Free trade is the way to go. And the trouble is the people in South America, Brazil and Argentina and Chile and Peru and Ecuador and Guatemala, they're all going, of course, to look after the interests of their people, their citizens, and our leaders are going to leave our borders wide open and further the impoverishment of the American people. And, of course, we are losing our industrial base so rapidly that, you know, looking down the line 3 or 4 or 5 years, we're not going to have an industrial base. We will simply be a service country, everybody providing services for everybody else. And as with both Spain and England that gave up their industrial base, so we too will become third world nations.
Yes. I think it's interesting to note that even though we have the technology to x-ray every single container or truck that comes into our nation very rapidly, that we don't utilize this equipment, and yet Mexico, which is supposedly an impoverished nation, has this equipment operating along its border with Guatemala. And so, for example, if there's a truck supposedly filled with bananas and there's a few certain areas where humans might be hiding, they can detect that in a glimpse. But we don't bother to operate similar equipment along our borders or in our harbors, which would provide us with much more adequate security. It's sort of ironic. We have the technology, we have the skills to do sophisticated searches that could be very rapid, but for some reason we don't employ these techniques, but we have this technology which is being used by other nations who are concerned about their nation's security.
Well, of course, we have our troops over in Japan, and we have our troops over in South Korea, and we have our troops over in Europe, and we have troops all throughout Africa and in Middle East, but we don't have any troops to guard our own borders here. Somebody sent me an email and said, you know, it's the most amazing thing that there was one cow that was a downer, and they were able to determine it had mad cow disease. Then they were able, of course, to trace the origin of that cow back to Canada.
Yep.
They were able to trace all the other cows that came in with that cow. They were able to track the offspring of those cows all over the United States. We got almost 12 million illegal immigrants in the United States, and we can't track any of them down. What's wrong with this picture? And, of course, the thing is, we're not trying to track down the 12 million illegal immigrants. That's the reason, and for the same reason, we're not really trying to guard our borders against contraband coming in. The Mexicans can do it, but, gee, we just can't do that. We must be very inefficient. And I don't believe that for 1 minute. I believe they know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the American public to know what they're doing.
That's so true. Just like the analogy I tried to give earlier about keeping information from the public in general during time of war. Unfortunately, Central America, we do not fully understand the situation there. We don't realize that even though Daniel Ortega is no longer in charge of Nicaragua, that his military forces basically at the drop of a hat can take control of that nation again if need be. But for some reason we think that everything is very stable and secure, and the same thing is true to a certain extent also in neighboring El Salvador. And it's only through a miracle, I think, and divine providence that during the Cold War that the former Soviet Union was unable to establish a fairly solidified base in Fonseca Gulf, which, of course, is larger than San Francisco Bay and could have housed their entire naval fleet during the winter months. But for some reason, the American people have been kept unaware as to what is transpiring even here in the Western Hemisphere. And the same sort of things are occurring now within Brazil with its Marxist leader in power at this time. So we need to become a little bit more aware of what is going on in these areas before we ever consider such a thing as FTAA, and we must understand that most of our congressmen are prepared to vote after the primary and general elections on this issue, and we need to find out now where they stand so that we don't vote them in again.
Well, I think that any congressman who's voted for NAFTA or for World Trade Organization should be voted out of office. I don't care how they vote on abortion. I don't care how they vote on traditional family values. They have voted to destroy the economic structure of this country. And if they didn't understand what they were doing, they're not fit to be in office. And if they did understand what they were doing, they're certainly not fit to be in office. So I think it behooves every person listening to this program to find out how their congressman voted and then to start circulating information on that right now for the coming up elections in November.
That's a very good point. On the issue of abortion, there are so many so-called righteous conservative Republican congressmen who will boast with pride that they are pro-life, but in reality they vote for permanent normal trade relations with the People's Republic of China, where over there you have no human rights, you have no choice, really. It's an abortion policy, and yet they boast over here that they are pro-life, which means they're basically hypocrites. And there are other congressmen who are still in office, but in 1989, most of them voted for disbanding our armed forces under disarmament, and that's occurring now through Homeland Security. So I think Americans should take a close look at the voting records of their congressmen. In fact, if every citizen did that, all of them would practically be out of office.
Well, that's what the McCain-Feingold bill was all about. That was to keep special interest groups like Gun Owners America and other organizations from publishing the voting record of elected legislators, and I'm speaking of congressmen and senators, within 60 days of the elections. Now, most people don't even care how their elected representatives voted until, you know, just before the election. And the McCain-Feingold bill was an attack on the First Amendment. It was upheld by the Supreme Court. And it's basically to keep the public from knowing how their elected representatives have voted. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, if you agree or you disagree with what we're saying. But I really believe that people have to know how their elected representatives vote, and then, of course, we have to do everything we can to get those people out of office. And even if they may have a pretty good conservative voting record, until our elected representatives know that they're going to be out of work if they continue betraying us, or if they have betrayed us on these trade issues, why, this is going to continue. And this is one situation there is no compromise on. America is being destroyed today by the trade policies that are a direct result of NAFTA and the World Trade Organization. And this was always known exactly what was going to happen, this wonderful idea of redistribution of wealth, the redistribution of the wealth of the American population. Well, we've got Joan Parrish calling in here. Hi, Joan. How are you doing?
Great. Dr. Stan, just a comment, if I may. I was at the United Nations Financing for Development Conference in Monterrey, Mexico, and that's been, a couple of years ago now.
Yes.
And I was in a complimentary shuttle vehicle with an undersecretary of the United Nations whose office was in Geneva, Switzerland. And I was carrying on a conversation with the driver because in outskirts of Monterey, there are these huge, huge factories built that from the United States. And so I said to the driver, I said, so with all of these factories and with NAFTA now, your standard of living must have been raised so that the Mexican people probably prefer to stay home rather than coming across the border. And he just laughed and he said, no, our standard of living has not changed at all. They still would prefer to go to the United States that can earn much better wages. So it's just, you know, it's cheated and destroyed people on both sides of the border.
Amen to that. Anything else, Joan?
That's it.
Okay, God bless. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Do you have any comment at all on what Joan was saying there, John?
Well, I'm very much aware of the iron and steel industry in Monterrey, in Mexico. It's very highly industrialized. Locally, they might have a very high standard of living for the workers there within that immediate area, but unfortunately, that's sort of a unique phenomena in itself. But the steel mills are relatively up-to-date, modern, compared to what we have here in the United States. Their steel fabrication is quite outstanding. I don't know if they've continued to make improvements on this in recent years, within the last decade or not, but it was certainly a fairly viable industry a few decades back.
Well, you know, the amazing thing was that our government subsidized so much of this industry down there. In other words, people could borrow money at 3% interest, and they were given a lot of money. We were actively doing everything we could to build up the economy of the industries in Mexico, and we've done the same thing with the industries in China. Why would we subsidize people, our factories, moving out of our country? Because our leaders have a different worldview. I mean, their loyalty is not to America, but to this internationalist dream of helping everybody in the world at the expense of the Americans. And, of course, they've done so much of this with borrowed money, money that, of course, we're eventually going to have to pay back, either, you know, through taxation or simply by inflating away the value of that money and in the process impoverishing the middle class, which will mean that their annuities and their bonds and their CDs and their bank holdings and everything they else think that they has value and monetary value will simply be wiped out by inflation.
Yes. I thought we might just touch upon the Middle East for a moment.
Okay.
And you have referred to a study that was done several years ago before the Bush administration came to power.
You're talking about the policies of the Project for the New American Century?
Yes. But I don't know if too many Americans are aware of the fact that this information was initially supplied to us by Israeli agents. And just by coincidence, during the same time period, one of the former high-ranking intelligence officers of Israel retired and went to Central Asia and became the chief negotiator for Turkmenistan and I believe also Uzbekistan and perhaps even Azerbaijan across the Caspian Sea for various oil dealings and promoting. And he was one of the first that came to the conclusion that oil pipelines would be necessary to transport the oil efficiently out of the Caspian area and looking for routes that would be southward other than through Iran. And for some reason, when you look at the situation that we're involved with in Iraq and in Afghanistan, we don't seem to fully understand that a lot of this geopolitical entanglement was the result of these policies that were first initiated by the Israelis and then later became supposedly our own thoughts here and in the current Bush administration. So I think that's one thing we need to understand. And if I were an Israeli official, I would have been very concerned about the viable threat that Iraq had towards Israel. But as an American, it's very difficult for us to see Iraq at any time being a viable threat to to our nation's security here in the United States. But of course, we seem to be more concerned with the security of other nations over our own. And this is one thing that must change if America is going to survive.
I agree with you totally. We've got Roger calling in from Pennsylvania. Roger, do you have a question or comment?
Yes, thanks, Jennifer. I was hoping one of you folks could answer. I've got a long-standing historical question regarding Taiwan. And am I correct in my guess that mainland China, for long, even pre-communist, never had any regard, concern, or historical claim for the then island of Formosa? It was unworthy of interest, and that any such territorial claim didn't even occur to the communists until after Chiang Kai-shek embarrassed them with success.
All right, John, maybe you can comment on that, because I'm not really qualified. You heard Roger's question.
Yes.
Was Formosa ever part of Greater China?
Well, if we go back to some of the earlier dynasties, we can probably lay some claim of Formosa or Taiwan as being a part of China. But you must understand, for more than a century now, China has only been vaguely under the control of China for 6 years. And during that 6 years, it was actually when the nationalist Chinese had control of mainland China as well as Taiwan.
Yeah, so that would have been a post-communist claim.
But you must understand, from about the late 1800s, around 1895 until 1945, that island was controlled primarily by the Japanese, who built up the infrastructure and left somewhat of a legacy behind in terms of hydroelectricity and rail lines and bridges. And of course, Chiang Kai-shek and his government was able to turn Taiwan into a very prosperous nation, a nation which is not a democracy, but rather a representative republic with a constitution. There are now over 22 million skilled Chinese or Taiwanese on that island. Certainly that in itself is an asset. What we need to understand is, if Taiwan were to fall by default, primarily on the part of the United States, we have neighboring South Korea, Japan, and the Philippines to consider.
So then basically, even if American administrations relaxed over 30 years of perfidy now against freedom, so the Chinese claim is against the bodies and souls of men, and even if floodgates were open to military hardware, the Taiwanese could not possibly, in their wildest dream, hope to be any kind of military threat to the mainland, yes?
That is true at this time, very definitely. In fact, currently, Taiwan does not have an adequate defense from the mainland, which has, conservatively speaking, at least 500 missiles pointed directly at that island nation, and I believe far more than that.
And we've really blocked the efforts of the Taiwanese to have an adequate defense, and we certainly blocked their effort to be able to retaliate against the mainland. So it's only a matter of time before I think the American people realize that we have once again betrayed the nationalist Chinese. So, but it's sort of like deja vu all over again, all over again. Hey, thanks so much, Roger. Anything else you want to ask? All right, well, that was Roger from Pennsylvania. This is really such a tragic situation. It's a powder keg. Certainly the situation as far as North Korea is a powder keg. And nothing that's going on there makes any sense. How is it that the wicked communist dictator is able to stay in power? Why, we're keeping him in power. We're providing him with food. It's all in the name of humanitarianism, because people are starving. Trouble is, we give the food, it goes to the military, and the people people still starve, but we manage to give enough food to keep the military fed so they don't rise up. And then, of course, we're providing oil for the generating plants, and we're helping them build a nuclear power plant. We're doing everything we can to keep the North Korean dictator in power. At the same time, we're saying, oh, what a terrible guy he is. You know?
Yes.
And then, of course, the North Koreans are providing missile technology to Pakistan. But where do they get their missile technology? I mean, do you really think they make that in North Korea? No, they get that from Communist China. And where does Communist China get their missile technology?
A good share of it from Russia.
Yeah, but a lot of
and
it's
also
from
the United States.
United States, right.
Yes. I thought I just might mention in jest, but it's very true that since we have more or less been hyping up the situation with respect to North Korea, ironically, we have been redeploying many of our American troops in South Korea over to Afghanistan and to the Middle East. And of course, Dr. Stan, you and I are very concerned that we're grinding down our armed forces in that part of the world, which is going to make it more difficult for us to assist with the defense of our few loyal friends throughout the world, as well as our own nation. And so people need to understand that we may have some good intentions, but at the same time, we need to establish a priority which includes the United States first. We don't have control of our own borders right now, and that's part of our nation's security, and yet we're willing now to sign on to FTAA, when FTAA is basically going to allow even more illegal immigrants to enter into the United States, but from a much larger area than just Mexico and Central America.
Amen to that. Well, we're in real trouble as a nation. John, I want to thank you so very much for being with us tonight. It's always a pleasure having you here and right on Radio Liberty and sort of giving us an overview of all of these things that are happening in the world. And I share your concern about the free trade of the America's Association. I think that the American people should understand that our leaders who are pushing free trade and free FTAA and CTAA and all of these other organizations,
yes,
they do it because their loyalty is not to America but to the internationalist dream. God bless you, John. We'll look forward to having you on once again here at Radio Liberty.
And I look forward to having you on March 4th on my program.
Well, no, it's not March 4th. It's got to be the weekend after that.
I beg your pardon. I thought I said March 14th.
March 14th it is.
Yes.
God bless. Good night.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan. This is the time, of course, we want to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We're dependent upon those of you out in the listening audience to help us. And if you'd like to know more about the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And of course, if you'd like a free copy of our latest newsletter, we'd be glad to send it to you. Please go to our website at radioliberty.com. Please tell others about our radio programs, encourage them to listen, and to become informed and begin to understand that behind everything that's going on, there are dark and sinister spiritual forces, for truly we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. There really are secret societies, and if you doubt that, you need my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Again, our number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers, but please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.